Did you hear why you were gone? Didn't you hear the Roman's father died while you were gone? Did you hear?
She was on the plane back with me. The airport. Good morning, everybody. It's good to be back. I'm not going to talk about Purim Mishulash. I will simply not talk about it. I imagine that between Phil Chernovsky and Rabbi Adler, you know all there is to know about Purim Mishulash, except for one thing. I come from Har Nof, and since I come from Har Nof, then I have to find some kind of a chumrah that nobody ever thought of before. And I did succeed. I did succeed in coming up with something, and I make this suggestion very humbly to all of you. There is an unknown statement in the Shulchan Aruch by the Ramah. The Shulchan Aruch is made up of the Rabbi Yosef Karo and the commentary or the additions of the Ramah. The Ramah says that it's a minhag to eat Zeir Onim on Purim. Zeir Onim are grains. And he says Zecher, a commemoration of the fact that Daniel and his friends Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah didn't eat from the food that was given to them by Nebuchadnezzar. Instead, they lived on grains. I imagine some kind of a macrobiotic diet. All right. So therefore, there's a minig to eat grains on Purim, and the Shulchan Aruch also says the Mishnah Berurah says that Esther and her girls also did not eat from the food that was given in the palace, but they ate grains, very simple foods. There was a Rav in Yerushalayim some years ago, 100, 150 years ago, who said that you can be yotze this minig by eating arbus, chickpeas. The only thing is, what I came up with is the fact that when there are 3 days Purim, nobody has rendered a decision on what day do you eat arbus. So I have told the members of my congregation to eat arbus on Friday, to eat arbus on Shabbos, and to eat arbus on Sunday.
Arbus is not a grain. Why not rice or something else?
That's why I needed the fact that there was an opinion of an early Rav in Yerushalayim who said that you can be yotze with arbus, though it's not a grain, but I imagine because it's simple and it's difficult to make arbus treif, it's not so simple to make arbus good. I mean, there's arbus and there's arbus. This is my only contribution to the, as a commemoration that Esther and her girls did not eat from the food of the palace of Ahasuerus, but they ate very simple grains, beans, or peas. I mean, if I want to, I can extend this, of course, into Purim Torah and say that, well, on Purim we eat kidneys, but on Pesach we won't eat kidneys, understand? You know, we can do whatever we want. Anyway, the important thing is what I decided for this morning, and here is another introduction. Between Phil last week and me this week, you've lost out on something. What you lost out was amazing. One of the byproducts of Purim Mishulosh in Yerushalayim is that in Yerushalayim this week, the Haftorah that's going to be read is going to be precisely the same Haftorah of last Shabbos. Only time it ever happens. The same Haftorah is read twice. In the rest of the world, outside of Yerushalayim, they're going to read the Haftorah for Parashat Tzav. But we're going to repeat over here the Haftorah from Sefer Shmuel, where Shmuel tells Shaul to go destroy Amalek. And what happened is, you got lost between me and Phil. He didn't talk about the Haftorah, and I'm not going to talk about the Haftorah, so a Haftorah that's read twice, you're not even going to learn once. But we're going to make up with it by learning a few psukim in the in Megillat Esther. That's what I want to do. It's been traditional that we talk about Purim or we talk about Megillat Esther. There's a great deal to say about these few psukim. In total, I think we're going to learn 7 psukim. Now, if some of you, when you turn over your sheet, it's upside down, so that you have to turn it around, it's only because I have a new Xerox machine and I haven't gotten the hang of how to do it yet. But we're starting with chapter... If you don't have a problem, don't complain. There are most of you don't have a problem. All right. Achar HaDvarim Ha'ele. Beginning of chapter 3. Achar HaDvarim Ha'ele, following these things, Gidal HaMelech HaChashverosh Yetoman Ben Hamdosa Ha'advogi Vayenaseu. After these things, King Achashverosh raised to greatness Haman Ben Hamdata the Agagite. The Agagite. Agagi, by the way, is what the Haftorah of last week and this week is about. Shmuel killing Agag, king of Amalek. Vayenaseyu, and he raised him. Now listen to the terms that are used. First of all, Gideil made him great. Then, Vayenaseyu, he raised him. By Yosem et Kiso, there was a further stage. By Yosem et Kiso, he placed his throne Me'al Kol HaSorim HaSherito from above all of the other ministers that were there. The Malmum over here points out, first of all, that there is a progression. There's a progression. You don't simply take somebody from some lowly position and turn him into the prime minister. You know, you have to go step by step. And he says, this is how he explains by Yosef, when Paro wants to make Yosef the Mishneh Lemelech, the second to the king, it doesn't happen in one single instant of time. First, he appoints him in charge of the house of Paro, in charge of the palace. Then he makes him a sar, a minister. It's only in the final stage that he becomes the second to the king over the entire realm. All right, so that the pasuk is telling us of a progression of events, but it's all jammed into one pasuk, because whichever way you look at it, this is ultimately a meteoric rise to power from being another one of his advisors, and now he becomes not only the second to the king, in a certain sense, he's going to become the king. V'chol avdei hamelech asher b'shar hamelech, all of the servants of the king who are in the gate of the king, within the palace, korim u'mishtachavim la'aman. They bend and they prostrate themselves before Haman. This is a much greater stage than all of the rest. And you know why they're doing it? This is how what the king has commanded him. Now, the king tzivolo hamelech can be understood either the king commanded all of them about him, kichen tzivolo hamelech. Or you can also say that the king is telling Haman, I want everybody to bow down to you, and you're going to have to live with that. Now, it's not simple what's taking place over here. There's something quite profound, and I found that one of the Mefarshim, Rabbi Yeshua Bachrach, says something that Rashid reminded me of the words of the Rav of Soloveitchik many years ago. I remember hearing this. Achar hadvarim ha'ele, after these things, after what? What happened at the end of chapter 2? What happened at the end of chapter 2 was that there was a threat, an assassination threat to the life of the of Achashverosh, Dinkson Vaseresh. Mordechai is the one who uncovers the plot He tells Esther. Esther tells the king in the name of Mordechai that Bigs and Vaseresh have were going to attempt an assassination. There's an investigation. Vayivukash hadavar vayimatse. If you'll take a look at the last pasuk of chapter 2. Vayivukash hadavar vayimatse. They investigated. It wasn't simply that they decided that they're going to be put to death. And not simply that, they were collaborators and he just put them to death. There was a trial. They were investigated. And it was found out that it was true. They did it, they had planned an attempt on the life of the king. Both of them were hung. And it was written down into the chronicles of the king, before the king. So here was an assassination plot. Just an interesting comment that's made by one of the Midrashim. Rab Levi said in the name of Harachav Rab Shila, "Mein Sifro Shel Basav Adam." Imagine if in the chronicles of a king of flesh and blood, everything is written and inscribed. You can be absolutely certain that in the journals that are kept by the Rabbeinu Shleilam up there, everything is going to be written. And he quotes a pasuk in Malachi, "Oz nidberu yirei Hashem ish el reyehu." Those who fear God spoke to one another. Vayakshev Hashem, God listens. Vayishma, and he hears. Vayikatev sefer zikaron, everything is written down in the book of Chronicles above. As I read this medrash, it occurred to me, and we're going to get back to that yet, the Zohar and the Sifrei HaKabbalah say that what is the greatness of Yom HaKippurim? It is a day like Purim. Unbelievable. Can you imagine a statement of our rabbis? That the most solemn and holy day of the year, if you want to know its significance, then it's because it's like Yom Kippur is like the most frivolous day of the year, Purim. But if in the Megillah it says that everything is written down there before the Melech Boss of Adam Achashverosh, you can be sure that everything is clearly recorded for all time. And by the way, what we're talking about is being recorded over here. Was the mitzvah that was performed by Mordechai, the good deeds. God made sure that all the good deeds are written. Anyway, so Rabbi Yehoshua Bachrach, as the Rav had said, in the beginning of the Megillah, how many days, I can't figure out how many days, 180 days, there were parties. The king was there in the presence of everybody. He was the life of the party. He was jovial. He was meeting people from all over the world. They came to prostrate themselves before him. It was a time of great joy and happiness and festivity. A dramatic change takes place. We're going to find out somewhere down the line about another chapter. Anybody who attempts to enter the throne room of the king without having been invited, instant death. Achad dato lahamit milvad, except if the king will extend his golden scepter. Which means, of course, that the king in this big throne room is sitting with his back to the wall and his eyes are at the door, so that he'll see anybody who's standing there. And there most probably are big fellas with those, you know, Arabian Nights kind of pajamas they're wearing, with swords that can cut somebody into shreds. What's happened over here? Do you know what's happened over here? Achashverosh has simply withdrawn into a bunker kind of existence. He's a frightened person. And there's going to come a night when he's going to hear rustling of the leaves in the garden. Middle of the night, he can't sleep. And he asks, "Mi b'chatzer, who's out there?" he's frightened of a driven leaf. And they tell him, ah, it's Haman. Okay, Yavo, let him come. Yavo Haman. Do you know what has happened to the king? The king knows that there was a plot to assassinate him. Does he have any idea how many more there are waiting out there? How many more people are there that are waiting to cut him down? Do you know what he begins to think? He was a commoner who had risen to power. There's only one commoner in history that rose to great power without doing it over the bodies of hundreds of thousands of people. And that was Yosef HaTzadik. Yosef rose to power because he interpreted a dream. This Ahasuerus has most probably left a trail of blood, death, destruction. There are many people out there who are gunning for him. And now he knows that not only are there people out there after him, they were even able to make it into the palace to the two people who are closest to him. Do you know what he understands? He understands that he may be in grave, grave danger. So all of a sudden, a whole different mentality, bunker mentality. He's going to hide within the palace. He's going to sit in his throne room with his back against the wall. He's going to be able to see anybody who comes in. Anybody who dares enter his throne room without having been invited. You kill first and don't even bother to ask questions afterwards. So you know what he needs? He needs somebody who's going to represent him in the eyes of the world. Anybody who wants to get at the king is going to have to get to Haman first. It's not an easy task that Haman has undertaken. But Haman, first of all, he changed Sifalo Amelech. Even if he doesn't like it, the king has commanded him, Habibi, you are going to be the target. You're the one they're going to bow down to. You're going to be in loco kingo, in place of the king. That's what you're going to be. The Rav once explained this by quoting from Khrushchev's memoirs. Khrushchev describes the death of Stalin. Stalin had, just as Ahasuerus had his Haman, Stalin had Beria. Beria was the head of the secret police. Beria, by instruction of Stalin, most probably put approximately 30 million people to death. He was a killer, most probably the greatest killer, the worst killer of the 20th century, that, by the way, had a few people that were real killers. But Beria most probably outkilled them all. There was some kind of a symbiotic relationship between Stalin and Beria. He knew that he can tell Beria, carry out death sentence on a million people, and he will do it. And he did it. 30 million in the 30s. 30 million in the 30s. And Khrushchev describes the members of the Politburo standing around the bed of Stalin, and finally the doctor says, Stalin is dead. Beria, who was standing there, began to laugh uncontrollably, and he spat at Stalin and ran out of the room in a hysteria of laughing. The Rav explained it. There's an unbelievable relationship between the two. Stalin needs Beria to be his killer. But you know what Stalin is afraid of? What's to stop the killer from turning on him? So that there was always a tension. Beria is frightened that Stalin, who can give the orders to kill 30 million people, can just as easily give the order, remove barrier. So the two of them are caught in a need-hate relationship, and the only moment, the moment at which barrier becomes free of that awesome emotional burden that he's been carrying is the moment that he sees that Stalin is dead. Haman and Ahasuerus are also going to have that kind of a relationship. Why do you think Esther succeeds? She's not sure what she's going to do. She invites him to the party, and she invites him again to the party. What is she trying to do by inviting him to the party? You know what she wants, the Gemara says? One of the things that she has in mind is she wants to leave Ahasuerus with the impression that there may be some kind of a relationship between Esther and Haman. This same Haman who's able to give the instructions to kill an entire people. And not only that, he was the one who advised Ahasuerus to put Vashti to death. Haman's a killer. And therefore, do you know what he becomes frightened of? The killer may turn on him. And that's why he comes in that morning, that early morning, because he wants to have Mordechai hung on the gallows that he has prepared for him. All of a sudden everything begins to change. He tells him, you take that Jew and you take him through the streets of Shushan, and you call before him, so shall be done to the man that the king wishes to honor. Ahasuerus is aware of what he's doing to Haman. He's aware that this same fellow that now everybody has to bow and bend before him as though he's some kind of a human deity, he's now taken that human deity and he has thrown him off his pedestal and is trampling on him, and the inevitable end is going to come the next day by the end of the second party. It'll be curtains for Haman. Achar hadvarim ha'ele, the Rav says, Achar hadvarim ha'ele, after Ahasuerus sees that there's been a plot on his life, and he now knows that he may be in grave danger from so many sources, he retreats, he withdraws, he disengages from the population. And the one who's now going to be in his stead, the one who's going to stand there, is going to be Haman, is the one who's going to be the stand-in, Saddam's double. You understand? The double. The stand-in. If there's going to be an assassination, the assassination is going to be against Haman, it's not going to be against Ahasuerus. Mordechai, here comes the great pasuk. Mordechai lo yichra, pasuk bet. Everybody's bowing down. Mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachve. And Mordechai will not bend, nor will he bow. Now this, of course, raises a very, very serious question. First of all, we have to understand why doesn't Mordechai bow or bend before him. The fact is that it's permitted to bow and bend before a human leader. Parsha Vayishlach, the great meeting between Yaakov and Esav. Bilhah and Zilpah and their children bow down before Esav Arasha. Leah v'yilodeha, Leah and her children, and then Yosef and Rachel. You can bow down. You can bow down. So of course the Gemara says that there are votes, there's an opinion that says that he placed some kind of a deity upon his chest, so that in a sense bowing down to him was bowing down to some kind of a deity. Maybe in a sense he was also presenting himself as some kind of a human deity, so therefore Mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachave. But there's something more to it. There's something more. The Medrash says the following, and the question, of course, is a is asked by the Maharal, by many, everybody asks the question. Mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtacha, then Mordechai will not bend, nor will he prostrate himself. So first of all, the Maharal says, lo yichra v'lo yishtacha v'eh is future tense, it's not past tense. That, the use of yichra and yishtacha v'eh means he will never, not now, nor in the future, will he ever bend or bow before him. Maral says it's written in Lashon Atid in future. Mifnei Shalona says there the Tanachat Uvad. It wasn't simply at this particular moment. Never. He's never going to bow down to him. Tamid. You know what else it means? Even though Mordechai could have sort of made himself scarce when Haman was around. You know, he didn't have to be there standing staring him in the face. So you hide, you know. You make sure that you're indoors, you hang. You know, there are so many ways to get out of it. Oh, no. There was something demonstrative about the fact that he will not bow and he will not bend. And then the Maral asks, Loma also said Mordechai. Why didn't Mordechai do this? Why did he do it? He should have removed himself from the gate of the king. So the Maharal brings a Gemara in Brachos that says a tzaddik is not afraid of confrontation with a rasha. A tzaddik gomer is not afraid. And brings a pasuk, Ozvei Torah, those who forsake Torah, Yehallelu Resha, they praise the evil. Shomrei Torah, those who keep Torah, yidgorubam, they will confront evil. Confront evil. Mordechai, by the way, in the Gemara is referred to as Mordechai HaTzadik. Just as Yosef is called Yosef HaTzadik, Binyamin was called Binyamin HaTzadik. And Shaul was called HaTzadik in the Gemara. By the way, they're all from the same family. They're all from the children of Rachel. But I want to read to you a medrash. All right. He says the following. Mordechai says, Ma omar lehem Mordechai, what did Mordechai say to those who asked him, Madu ata over o mitzvah hamelech, why do you transgress the command of the king? So he says, first of all, this man seems to be making himself an idol, and I believe in Torah's Moshe. We're opposed to all sorts of idols, human idols, inhuman idols, idols of gold and silver. And then he says, V'lo od. More than that. I happen to be very close to God. Shekol ha-shvotim noldu b'chutz laretz. All of the tribes were born in chutz laretz. Va'uzekeni, my Zayda, was born in Eretz Yisrael. He comes from Binyamin. He's Ishimini. If my Zayda was born in Eretz Yisrael, and if you're born in Eretz Yisrael, you don't bow down for any man.
Oh, wow.
And not only that, when they meet up with Yaakov, all of the Shvatim bow down before him except for one. Binyamin hasn't been born yet. Binyamin is Bime'ei Imo. He is in the womb of his mother. He doesn't bow down. I'm an Eretz Yisrael Dikiyid. And an Eretz Yisrael Dikiyid doesn't bow down for any Roshim Roshim. You understand? There's supposed to be a strength that we once saw, and in Yitzhak Hashem we will see again in the future, of the holy chutzpah of an Eretz Yisrael Yid. I can't even say Israeli anymore. An Eretz Yisrael Yid. Mordechai, he's not going to bow down. He will not bow down, just as his Zayde never bowed down. The Targum Sheni says, it was min hashamayim that Binyamin should not be born in Chutz Laretz. It was when Rachel became pregnant and they knew that the 12th and last of the shot was going to be born, that Yaakov tells his wives, we must get back to Eretz Yisrael. And he knows the reason why. Because the last of the Shvatim must be born in Eretz Yisrael. The one who's going to complete the house of Israel can't be born in Galus. Has to be born in Eretz Yisrael. Now, this is not... These are Midrashim, these are Mamore Chazal. This is not just some Zionist rabbi from Haranot saying this. Omar Mordechai. Yalkut Shimoni says the following. Mordechai said, "Ani eini yochol hachnif lo rasha hazeh. I can't flatter this rasha because I carry the style of the King God Himself. Toun signon shani, toun signon shel melech. Because what was said about Binyamin, Yedid Hashem. Binyamin is Yedid Hashem. Bein ktefav shachem, between the shoulder blades of Binyamin, that's where God rests. And that's why the Beit HaMikdash is built in the land that belongs to Shevet Binyamin. That's where the Rebbein Shalom can bring his divine presence down. Where the Shevet of Binyamin is. And you know what? Do you think that I'm going to let two Haftorahs go without having made a comment? When Shaul comes back, when Shaul comes back from the battle against Agag, and Shmuel hears the sheep, you may recall many years ago he says, and the way I read it, Umeh Kol Hatzon. And what's the sound, the bleeding of the sheep that I hear? And he tells him that the people, you know, he blames it on the people. And you left Agag alive, he blames them on the people. So Shmuel in the Haftorah says to Shaul, Halo in koton ata beinecho, if you're small in your own eyes, Rosh shiftei Yisrael ata, you are the head of the tribes of Israel. And the Medrash says, you know why tribes of Israel? The only one of the 12 tribes who was born after God changed Yaakov's name to Yisrael was Binyamin. Binyamin is the one who creates the entity called Shivtei Yisrael. Mordechai lo yichrav lo yishtachaveh. There may be a more serious problem over here. More serious problem maybe is it's such a terrible thing that Mordechai does. It's very difficult for me to even relate to it, but I can't help it. He refuses to follow orders. As soon as it says this is what the king had commanded, the immediate words afterward, Mordechai lo yichrav lo yishtachaveh, Mordechai will not bend but bow. Do you know what siruf nukuda? Do you know what refusal to follow orders can do? How destructive it is for the body politic. Everything's going to fall apart at the seams. So of all the fascinating things, yeah, I don't get that so fair every day. But when I need gas, so I go, there's a gas station at the entrance to Hanov that you can get a free hot so fair if you fill up with gas. So I think it was one of those days that I got a filled up with gas and I got a free hot so fair, and there was an article by Noam Arnon. Noam Arnon is the head of the Yeshuv HaYehudi B'Chevron. So in his article, it's really a takeoff on all of Megillas Esther, and he says that the struggle that takes place in all of Megillat Esther is it takes place on two levels. There's the chok, the law of Persian Medes, and there's chok Elokim, there's the law of God. The party at the beginning of the Megillah, hashtia kadat, the drinking is according to the law, everything is according to the law. The first one who refuses to follow orders, of course, is Vashti. The king commands her to come, and she doesn't come. She doesn't come. So, of course, you know what happens when somebody breaks the law and refuses to follow orders? Finished. Vashti. But what's fascinating, of course, is that they promulgate the law after she's killed. You know, you have to make it democratic. You have to make it chuki, legal. So you make it legal that after she's put to death, you say every wife has to listen to whatever her husband says. The whole story of the Megillah is man standing up to the law that is promulgated by man when that law is in conflict with God's law. God's law stands higher. Mordechai lo yichreb lo yishtachaveh. Not only that, in chapter 5, I believe it is, after Haman comes out of the first party, where he is already at the peak of his power, and he has already, we already know that he's Hitler, he has already promulgated a law to kill all Jews throughout the world. Legal law, signed and sealed with the seal of the king, all legal, to kill all the Jews. And he comes out of the party, and there's Mordechai, Mordechai lo kam v'lo zom imenu. And Mordechai didn't stand, nor does he shake before him. Nothing. And Haman becomes very angry. He comes home and he gathers his wife and children, and he tells them of his greatness and how he alone was invited to the party, and tomorrow he's invited to another party. So that's when they give him the advice to make that great gallows. I can't help, I remember something a few years ago. I think I mentioned it at one time. It was in the name of my brother, Olav Ashol, Rabbi Rav Yosef Yerim Kol, Olav Ashol. After Haman takes Mordechai through the streets of Shushan and proclaims, "So shall be done to the man whom the king wishes to honor," so it says he comes home and he's a broken man, and the family gathers, and you understand his wife tells him, "Im mizera Yehudim Mordechai asher hachilota lintolafanav, if this Mordechai from before whom you've begun to fall is from the children, the seed of the Jews, nafol tipol lifanav, you shall fall before him." I never heard a pshat to explain that. This is what you need a wife for. This is what you need a zeresh for. When you're falling, to tell you, "Well, hummy old hubby, nothing is going to help, because this the one you're falling before is he's a Jew, so you're finished. Forget it." No, my brother said a gewaldigavard. She tells him, "Listen, you've begun to fall before Mordechai. Don't worry. You know what you have to do? Nafol tipol afanav. Prostrate before him, yourself before him. Tell him, 'I recognize you. I'm going to call off all terrorism, no more terrorism. We're going to live together in peace forever and ever after. And we're going to send ambassadors to you. We're going to raise Jews for..." Just play the game. Fall before him. And you know what's going to happen? These Jews, they always fall for it. Gewaldigavort. Gewaldigavort. Mordechai lo yichrab lo yishtahaveh. Let's go another few psukim, because we haven't even gotten to the heart of the shir. It's unbelievable. Vayhi They said this to him every day. The servants of the king who are on the gate of the king said to Mordechai, why do you transgress the mitzvah of the king? The king said you should bow down. And it came to pass when they said it to him day after day, he didn't listen to them. He refuses to bow down. And they told Haman to see Hayamdu Divrei Mordechai. Who is going to emerge victorious here? Kihi Gidlam Hashem Hu Yehudi, because Mordechai told them. He told them, I'm a Jew, and I don't bow down for these guys. Vayar Haman. And then Haman saw, he took note of it. Kihi Mordechai Koreo Mishtaha Velo. Then Mordechai doesn't then bow. Vayimolei Haman Chema. Haman became full of anger. Vayigez Be'enov. And for him it was... it was an embarrassment for him to go out after Mordechai alone, so he decides, much easier, wipe out the whole Jewish people. Haman wanted to destroy all of the Jews in all of the kingdom of Achashverosh, the people of Mordechai. Chodesh Rishon, who Chodesh Nisan, on the first month, in the month of Nisan, Bishnat 12 LeMelech Achashverosh, in the 12th year of the king of Achashverosh, he peeled poor, he threw poor, who had goral, those halats, lefnei Haman, before Haman, miyom liyom, umei Chodesh lechodesh, shnei masor, who Chodesh Ador, from day to day, and from month to month, 12th month, who Chodesh Ador. In the 9th chapter of the Megillah, it's going to say that the Yontif is called Purim al shem hapur because of the lots that were thrown by Haman. Very strange name. The whole name is strange. A name you give because of the salvation. Pesach is called Pesach because God, Pesach, he went over the houses. We call it Chag HaMatzos because that's the mitzvah of the Chag. Sukkot is called Sukkot because we were under the Amanei HaKavod of God. But because of Rosh, Haman throws lots of the Yontif we celebrate as Purim. What does the Megillah mean? Why is it called Purim? So I'll just tell you something that's brought by the Chidah. The Chidah was one of the great, the Rav Chaim Yosef David Azulai, brings it's some kind of a medrash that says the following: Purim kolel kol hayomim tovim. Purim includes and embraces within itself all of the yomim tovim. It's Pesach. It's like Pesach because we go from slavery to freedom, and here we go from death to life. Shavuos is when Torah is given in the Megillah. It says Hodor Kibluah, that Jews accepted Torah anew in the days of Mordechai and Esther. Rosh Hashanah, because what's Rosh Hashanah? The book of life and death is open before God. That's exactly what was open before Him. What will happen to the Jewish people? Life or death? It's like Yom Kippur, because there Jews receive atonement for their sins. Here God gave them atonement for their sins, and therefore they were not destroyed. And then he says, that's why they called it Purim. Now, it's not bad, but it's slightly stretching it. Purim, so the Pei stands for Pesach. The Vav stands the Sukkot. The Reish is Rosh Hashanah. The Yud is Yom Kippur. The Mem is Matan Torah. Shavuos, when Torah is given. Cute medrash. I'm afraid we won't have the time really to delve into that medrash fully, but we do have to ask the question, why is it called Purim? I have four answers. The chances that I will do justice to these four answers when each of them needs an hour. So let's see. We'll see. Either we won't do justice to them. That's one possibility. The other is that we won't do all four. So we'll do a little justice to some of them. And the ones that I don't tell you, so we can ultimately, you know, Mias Hashem Gesundheit, next year we'll say another year. You know, another year. the Malbim over here says the following. That's why I have the Malbim for you. I'm not going to read it inside. I'll tell you what happened over there. In the Pasuk it said that Haman threw lots liyom liyom. The first thing, he drew lots to find out which day of the month. The second lots he threw were chodesh lechodesh. When did he do this process? You don't have it there, but a few psukim later in this same chapter, it says that the this took place b'chodesh harishon Nisan b'shlosha osa yombo, the 13th day of Nisan. On the 13th day of Nisan, the day before Erev Pesach, that's when he throws or casts lots. That's a better word. Casts lots. So the Malbim makes the following calculation. He wants to get rid of these Jews fast. So the first thing is he goes through some kind of process to find out whether the next day, the 14th. No, 14th isn't good. Doesn't come out good. 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30. The lots show these days are not good. And then he starts the numbers all over again. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. When he comes to the number 13, which is obviously the last possible number, because he's doing it on the 13th, and he wants to figure out which day is propitious for this kind of a destruction of the Jewish people. All right, so now he finally got the date. Now what he needs is the month. What month is he in? He's in Nisan. All right? So he starts with Iyar. The stars don't seem to say Iyar. Not Sivan. Tammuz? No. Av? No. Elul? No. Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev, Tevis, Shvat. Finally, Adar. Do you know what it means? At the very first moment when he is planning the destruction of the Jewish people, we can already see these are not plain lots that are being drawn. God is a cheater. You understand? God is the one that's manipulating it, you understand? He's a card shark, the Rabbi Yisrael. It ends up the last possible day and the last possible month. So I say, on the basis of this Malbim, it's called Purim because the miracle begins before the decree is even decided upon. In the very drawing of the lots, God is giving them the greatest amount of time possible. There's something I told you a few years ago, on which basis I this year it occurred to me that that may be an answer to the question of why we call the Yom Tov Purim. You may remember, if you remember, it's good to go over it again anyway. It's a story that became famous in the United States, certainly My Flat Tire. Great! Nobody remembers the flat tire. You remember the flat tire? Okay. The flat tire is now going to be an answer to the question of why the Yom Tov is called Purim. A few years ago, I think it was in 1999, that's 6 years ago, I arrived with my wife in Newark Airport. We were on our way to a rabbinic conference, a conference of young Israel rabbis. So we arrived at night. I picked up a rental car at the Newark Airport, and I said, I don't know how to say it in English, but I can say it in Hebrew, Kibalti upgrade. I got an upgrade from the little or medium sized car that I had ordered. They gave me a car that's just a little bit smaller than a Merkava tank. Anyway, I get into this car, it's obvious, you know, I drive a little car, and we all drive little cars over here. This was a car fit for a Kablan. They're the ones that drive out with it. Okay. All I needed was a big cigar. Anyway, we start driving, and you just put your foot down on the gas, and the thing is flying across the highway. It's flying. I turn to my wife, and I say, "What a car! I never drove a car like this. It's great. Do you feel it?" "Yeah." "Dale, what a car! Do you feel it?" "Yeah." She's getting tired of me already. By the third time I say it, in all Hasidic stories, everything happens at the third time. I tell her, "Oy vey, what a car!" Then I hear a thump, a thud, and it becomes me black before the eyes. And I just happen to get the car off to the side of the road, right near an exit off the highway, and I come out and I take a look. I have a flat tire. It's dark. It's about 8 o'clock at night in February. It's very, very cold. Very cold. And I don't know how to change a flat tire. So there we are. We're sitting around and we don't know what to do. Standing around. And of course I begin bemoaning my fate. And I had an important engagement in Brooklyn that night. I didn't know how I was going to make it. Having a very difficult time with it, and oy vey, what's going to be? Oy Dale, listen, Zomitins, we'll never get off this highway. I looked around, there were no gas stations, there was nothing, there was hardly any traffic on the highway. Oy vey, oy vey, oy vey, oy vey. It's getting very cold, and it's getting very late. And then, in a moment of great decisiveness, I say to my wife, "Pela, I'm going to change the tire. I don't know how to change the tire. We're going to go to the glove compartment and I'm going to take out the instruction booklet. I just hope there's an instruction booklet there." Now, meanwhile, you have to understand that in the Megillah, everything is taking place on two levels. There's the earthly level below, and then there's the divine level above. Everything, though God's name is not mentioned in the Megillah, but the God is the one who's really running everything that's taking place over there. So I already know what's going on up in heaven. Up in heaven there are Malachim who said, "Kabeni Shleilam, Sholem and Bela Gold are stuck on the highway. What do you think? You leave them on the highway like that?" There is no response from the Rabbeinu Shlom. Absolute silence. All of a sudden a Malach comes running in and says, "He made a decision, he's going to change the tire." No response. I put my hand into the glove compartment and I take out the instruction booklet. And a Malach comes flying in. He has the instruction booklet in his hand. There's a slight smile from the Rabbeinu Shlom. Nothing else. Nothing else. Anyway, we have to read it. So there was one street lamp there. We're freezing. We're sitting, standing under the street lamp. We get to the page where it says how to change a tire. The first thing you have to do to change a tire is get out the jack. I open the trunk. They've already reported to the Rabbeinu Shlom, he's opened the trunk, he's gone for the jack. Still no serious response from the Rabbeinu Shlom. But it seems that there was some kind of wrist action that was necessary in order to dislodge the jack from its spot. And I tried and I tried, I gave up a few times, my hands were freezing already, my fingers didn't know that they were there. And then I don't know what happened. I have the jack in my hand. And I go over to the car, I put the jack under the car. In heaven, Rabbeinu Shalom, the jack is under the car. All of a sudden, a big truck comes screeching to a halt, and out in the dark comes a black man, a big black man, comes toward me, and I start saying, "Shema Yisrael." Man, you're in trouble. I'm going to help you. Yeah, man, I'm in trouble. Give me that jack. We didn't finish speaking yet. And a red car comes screeching to a halt, and a very blonde white man comes out, an off-duty policeman who says that he was cruising around and he saw you were in trouble. He went to the next exit, came around, made his way back, and here he is, and he sees my wife is freezing. His wife is in the car. He says, come, your wife will sit in the car so she can warm up. We're going to change the tire. Before my wife goes into the car, she says, I know you were ready. You're going to make a drosha out of this story. So I told her, you don't understand. I already have the drosha. End of the story is that the two fellas, they changed the tire. Now, about the very end, or next to the end of the story, there are really two versions. One is mine, and one is my wife. As far as I'm concerned, I saw the truck drive away with this big Schwarzer, drive away for about 100 meters, and then disappeared into the heavens. Ze lo kushi, ze elio hanavi. My wife is not that sure. She thinks that it really continued going, you know, but she can't be sure what happened 200 meters up. We got into the car. We made it to our appointment, even though I was afraid I wouldn't make it. What was my appointment? This was very important. In those years, there was one last thing left in Chutz Lars. There was nothing left to go for the Chutz Lars. Now there's nothing to go. Now there's nothing to go. But then there was still one thing left. There was a steak at Kosher Delight, 46th Street and 13th Avenue in Borough Park. And I thought they closed at 10:30. I got there at 10:45. They were still open. And I said, can I have a steak? Yes. Yes. I had it. What's the drosha part? As soon as I got to where I was staying, I opened up in Megillas Esther. And I found out that the Megillah, this was going through my head, my frozen head, out on the highway. There are 163 psukim in the Megillah. If there are 163 psukim in the Megillah, that means there are 83 psukim on one side, 83 psukim on the other side. Pasuk 84 is the epicenter of the Megillah. Pasuk 84 in the Megillah is at the parting. Vatan Esther Vatomar. Esther answered and she said, She'elati u'bakashati. I have a request that I'm going to go after. Do you know what happens at that moment in the Megillah, at that center of the Megillah? From being acted upon, she is now taking the initiative. From the moment that she takes the initiative and further, it's only going to be success until the ultimate destruction of Haman and the rescue of the Jewish people. As long as they were concerned and they were worried and they were praying and they're fasting, and praying is good and fasting is good, but praying and fasting have to be joined together with action. Purim is the poor. The poor is the Gorol. Gorol represents the idea that life is chance. And I'm a victim of chance. I was a victim of a flat tire. Poor me! Poor me!
Poor.
Poor. Good. Poor me. What's necessary in life is, the Rav would have used the following terminology. Would have used the Brisker terminology. A human being can be a chafetz, can be an object. An object means that all sorts of things act upon him, and he doesn't have the courage, the strength, the determination, the will to stand up to it. But a human being's purpose in life is not to be an object that's acted upon. A human being in life has to be a gavra. a person, a man, with will, with tenacity, with a goal, with an objective, a willingness to fight, to stand up. In the Megillah, at Pasuk 84, do you know what happens? You know what's happened till then? When Esther says, let's pray and fast, she's taking out the instruction book from the glove compartment. During the course of the fasting and the praying, she's going for the jack. When she puts her life on the line and she walks in to the throne room, she has the jack under the car. It's at that moment that the Rebbein Shem sends his Siyata Dishmaya, his black man, his white man. There's no Siyata Dishmaya, there's no hand of God until the moment that you have moved from being an object and have become a gavra. You've been inactive to active. Acted upon, or the one who begins to call the shots. From She'elati u'Bakashati, the one who's giving all the instructions, the one who's telling everybody what to do, the one who's got everybody turning around, is Esther. That's the moment at which Yeshua begins. The Rebbein Shem can only bring Yeshua when we turn around and do that which we are supposed to do. Which means, therefore, the Yontif is called Purim in order to tell us that just as Esther and Mordechai did not permit themselves to be the victim of lots, but they became the masters of their lots. They became the masters of their destiny. They took it into their own hands. Then the Rebbein Shem sends his aid and his assistance. So that the whole idea of the name Purim is never ever to permit ourselves to say, oh, what's it going to help? What difference is it going to make? And a demonstration does mean nothing in here. Nonsense. Everything we do helps. Everything we do is meaningful. To remain inactive, no good. The story of the Megillah is man acts down here and the Rebbein Shem responds from heaven. So to me he sent a black man and a white man. And you know what? He could have sent anybody just as long as they fixed their tire. I said this over, we had a bat mitzvah of an angel. And I told my granddaughter, when they're going to start bringing your shidduchim, and they're going to tell you he's a Talmud Chacham, and he's a Balmidus, and he's this and he's that. Tell the Shabkin to find out, does he know how to change a black tie? My postscript was that if he doesn't know how to change a flat tire, you learn how to change the flat tire. Chag Purim Sameach. אני שמעתי, אני ראיתי.
אני רציתי לדעת.
כן, אבל זה לא היה.
אתה מבין באמת.
יש! יש! אני יודע.